Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board. It may be winter, but work on the rivers happens all year long. Today, we'll hear from people who make their living on the water, like the captain of a boat who's been transporting coal along the river for a long time.
I had two job offers the same day, and I took this job. My dad always said, the river will be there, so that's what I've chosen to make my living at.
Many folks who work along the rivers get to see beautiful views, dawn till dusk. Of course, it's not always beautiful.
You'll have an island full of trash, different debris, tires, refrigerators, anything plastic just floats.
Today we'll hear stories of people who know our waters and what's in them and what lessons we can take away from them. You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia, I'm Glynis Board. A while back, we devoted an episode of Inside Appalachia to some of the ways people use our lakes, rivers, and streams for relaxation and enjoyment. That episode is called Paddle Boats, Whitewater Rafting, and Scuba Diving. In the mountains? Yep, inside Appalachia. You can listen back to that and all our episodes on our website, wvpublic.org. Today, we're taking another listen to an episode about people who work on the river to see how the water has shaped us and how we're impacting our waterways. It's become something of an afterthought, but our rivers are a vital part of our identity as Appalachians, and we depend on rivers for economic reasons, too. We'll hear from some of the people who make their living on the water. Many times, they see our trash long after we've forgotten about it. Eric Gardner sees a lot of garbage in the river. He works as an underwater diver, repairing towboats that drive barges along the rivers in West Virginia, Kentucky, and Ohio. Eric Douglas brings us this story.
Not many people enjoy working in the dark, wearing a mask while getting cold, and depending on others for their life support. But Eric Gardner does. In fact, he loves it.
Yeah, I'm a man of the river is what I say. I'm in the river industry. The company I started out with had some older gentlemen that ran that company and took a liking to me and taught me a lot of the trades that I still use to this day.
Gardner is a commercial diver. Mostly he works on the Kanawha and Ohio rivers, maintaining barges, pipelines, and spillways. The biggest challenge he faces is the lack of being able to see underwater.
Visibility and limited air. That's what I always try to explain. And most of everything you're doing is by feel.
Gardner grew up in Bell and East Bank, along the Kanawha River. His father died when he was four, and his mother raised him and three siblings. He says he got his work ethic from her.
She said, you know, as you get older, you'll realize that everything you work for, you got to do it for you. And get out here and hustle, and it will come to you if you work for it.
Being a commercial diver can be difficult work, but Gardner thrives on it. Summer or winter, he is underwater for 2 to 4 hours at a stretch. His support team above water maintains an air compressor that sends him air through a hose. One common task he performs is clearing towboat propellers, also known as props.
When they get debris into the props or have underneath damage or problems, they'll call me out. A lot of times it's trees, cables, ropes, wound up into props.
If Gardner can't fix the towboats, they have to travel to a dry dock up to 60 miles away and may be out of service for days. While we are talking, Gardner gets a call from a towboat captain that needs his help. He dives almost immediately into the river in his diving gear, armed with a hacksaw. Searching with his hands, he clears two large balls of old boat lines and debris in just a few minutes. He says one of the greatest challenges to working underwater is leverage. When you pull against something, your body moves the other way.
So you got to try to wrap your legs around what you're working on or stabilize yourself against the river bottom.
Spending so much time on and in the river, Gardner is troubled by the amount of trash he sees.
Most people think, what's one little bottle that I'm throwing in the waterway? When 3 million people think that, that's 3 million bottles.
The lock and dam systems make it possible for barge traffic to flow on the river but the trash fouls the locks.
You'll have an island full of trash, different debris, tires, refrigerators, anything plastic just floats.
Eventually, most of the trash makes it to the Mississippi and the Gulf of Mexico.
You know, it'd be nice if we could come up with a plan and try to work with the Army Corps of Engineers to where we may be able to stop this from happening.
Commercial diving is often considered a young man's game. Most of the divers Eric's age have retired or now work on the surface of the water to supervise. But at 54 years old, Gardner says he isn't quite ready to quit yet.
I try to stay in somewhat, a good shape and do most of the work myself. I enjoy it. It's part of my life. It's a big part of my life. I'd like to stay into it 6 more years till I hit 60. I got the good Lord above me. It watches over me on every dive.
Just like the old rivermen did with him when he was just starting out, Gardner likes to pass on the wisdom he's gained over the years.
Like I tell young people in this industry now, the young generation, that you got to want to learn, not just for a paycheck. You want to be involved in your work. Learn your trade.
In a few years, when he does retire, he plans to head for a place he considers his second home, Key West, Florida. There, he can dive without working so hard. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Eric Douglas in East Bank, West Virginia.
We followed up with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers about what Gardner said about the trash in the river. Their spokesman told us there is no safe and effective way for the locks and dam workers to remove the trash from the river. They treat it all like natural debris and let it float on downriver. The company that Eric Gardner works for is called Amherst Madison. And for most of their history, they've made the majority of their money towing coal barges. But a downturn in coal production meant the company had to look to other ways to stay afloat. Roxy Todd went to talk with some of the people who work at Amherst Madison about how they see the future of the riverboat industry. And while she expected to talk economics with them, the conversation took an unexpected turn.
When I hopped aboard the Dream of G. Woods at dawn, I didn't imagine that I'd be chatting with people about how the river industry is connected to the future of the planet. I certainly didn't imagine this would become a story about how people interact with the natural environment.
I got your buddy on here. We're going to come down there and get a bologna sandwich. You got any bologna?
Come on. Bring on.
Marvin L. Wooten is the captain of this boat. He started this job in 1979.
I had 2 job offers the same day, and I took this job. And my dad always said, the river will be there, so that's what I've chosen to make my living at.
Today, he's towing 5 barges of coal along the river, a load of more than 8,000 tons. A captain earns about $500 to $600 a day, usually more than $100,000 a year.
I've made a good living.
But it's not just the money that keeps Marvin working here after 40 years. It's also the camaraderie he feels for his crew and the rest of the men who work with him along this river.
I want to go where somebody knows me by name. And if you, they call them a mom and a pop place. And that's about what this is like, mom and a pop. You're like family here.
He shows me an article in a magazine featuring his boss, Charlie Jones.
The river man treats his people with respect.
When I'm on dry land, I go to meet Charlie in his office. One of the managers of this company, Alan Hall, introduces me.
He doesn't get around as well as he used to. You know, he's 101 now. Charlie!
Hello!
Got some of these folks from public broadcasting that want to chat with you, so...
Charlie sits behind his desk inside a sparse office furnished with practical secondhand furniture. This company has been in his family for over 100 years. He says he feels lucky to live this long and admits the days would feel boring without work to keep him busy.
Because all the people that you know are gone. You can't talk to your old buddies. Call them up on the phone. They're gone.
He isn't interested in retiring. He says he'd rather spend his days doing something other than eating or playing golf.
That just never appealed to me. I thought I'd like a little wider scope than that.
He says he has faith that his riverboat company will survive, but warns that they need to diversify. They won't always be able to survive by transporting coal.
If you look at all the companies that have tried to survive by doing the same thing, they haven't been able to make it.
Already, his company has taken on more jobs, shipping rocks, chemicals, and doing construction work along rivers and ports throughout the East Coast. They have jobs in Nashville and in Cairo, Illinois. They've diversified, Charlie says, largely because his company had to downsize a few years ago when the coal industry took a big hit. He blames the Obama administration for that.
President Obama started this crusade of shutting down coal mines.
He's referring to environmental regulations that put restrictions on the emissions from coal-fired power plants. At this point in our conversation, Charlie surprises me. He says that even though he doesn't agree with the way these regulations were rolled out, he says he does believe we have to clean up our air. He doesn't call himself an environmentalist, but a pragmatist.
Are we concerned about the quality of the air? Well, let's do something about it. We're not doing anything about it right now. I'd say there's a big challenge ahead of us.
He says he thinks the planet has a limit and points out that in his lifetime, the population across the globe has exploded.
I think you just got to be practical. You can't keep loading the planet up with people unless you do something with the toxicity they produce.
And he says this includes trying to reduce emissions from boats, or possibly even changing the type of fuel they use to power their fleet. They currently use diesel. But he says Amherst-Madison is looking to try to adapt to a renewable source of fuel one day. Charlie says he feels like most people ignore the river shipping industry when they talk about infrastructure or transportation.
And very few people know anything about it, particularly the politicians.
Infrastructure along the waterways is managed through the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. They maintain all the locks and dams, and their latest budget includes an increase in funding from the federal government to improve infrastructure along waterways, a total of more than $4 billion. That budget has been increasing every year since President Trump took office. There's also been a major change in how Charlie is managing the finances of his family's business. A few years ago, when his son, who was going to take over the family business, died from cancer, Charlie decided to turn over the ownership of the company to his 300 employees. As of this year, his employees all share in the fate and in the profits. Back on the towboat, Captain Marvin Wooten is cautiously optimistic about this new redistribution of the company's profits.
I'm 60 years old. I probably won't see a lot of rewards from it, but I got one boy downstairs that's 19 years old. He sticks around here till he's 35, 40 years old. He'll reap the rewards of it. And I think it's a good thing. If everything goes the way they're hoping it will, it should be a good thing for the employees.
Like Charlie Jones, Marvin says he's not interested in retiring anytime soon. He says he would miss the crew, the people he works with, as well as the views. As we pass the Marmette Locks and Dam, he points out an osprey, which has a nest nearby. He keeps a pair of binoculars handy. Lately, he's also begun to see more bald eagles.
I think there's four you can really see good on this river. They're starting to come back. You should not see them at all. See a lot of wildlife out here.
Do you ever feel like you get a different view of West Virginia than most people?
Well, yeah, I mean, I see the seasons change. See winter come. I see the hollers turn gold and stuff. I see that every year from up here.
As we continue downstream, pushing thousands of tons of coal to a power plant, I look around at the mist coming up over the mountains. I think of all the people being born now, and I wonder what will be left for them here on the river. And if riverboats are still around 100 years from now, what will they be carrying downriver? For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd, reporting from the Kanawha River.
And we're sad to report that Charlie Jones, the 101-year-old president of Amherst-Madison that you heard in that story, passed away just a couple of months after this story originally ran. In a minute, we'll hear the devastating story of how a coal ash spill in Tennessee left a toxic legacy, which could be harming people's health, as well as our natural environment. And we'll hear a story about how the river helped one veteran heal from post-traumatic stress disorder and addiction. But first, It's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. Since today we're exploring stories about how people interact with our rivers, we wanted to dig a little deeper into a debate we've had here in our newsroom, the origins of the name of one of our rivers, and how to pronounce it. If you've ever been to Morgantown, West Virginia, you've probably driven over or near the Monongahela River, or some people pronounce it Monongahela. So which is the correct way to say it? And where does the name originate anyway? We'll hear that after a break. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. Lately, it came to our attention that people pronounce the name of the 130-mile river that flows from northern West Virginia to Pittsburgh differently.
The name comes from one of several interpretations from some American Indian words that I can't pronounce for you, but which translate into place of many landslides or high banks or bluffs falling down in places.
That's Kelly Bridges, the public affairs officer for the Mon National Forest, which is named after the Mon River. Now, most people just say the Mon when referring to the forest or the river. It's easier than saying the full 11-letter word, but if you call the Mon National Forest Service, this is what you hear.
Thank you for calling the United States Department of Agriculture, Monongahela National Forest.
Tara Landevere is the tourism director for Randolph County, which includes much of the Mon Forest.
I pronounce it Monongahela, but my mom, I asked her the other day, and she says Monongahela.
Tara asked her coworkers, too.
The executive director pronounces it Monongahela, and his secretary pronounces it Monongahela, and the Cheat Ranger District ranger, Troy Wowski, he pronounces it Monongahela.
So this got us thinking, is there a right way to say the name? The word originates from the Lenape language spoken by the Delaware Tribe of Indians, a tribe that likely passed through northern West Virginia and southern Pennsylvania hundreds of years ago. We spoke with Jim Rementer, who's the language director for the tribe.
The proper Lenape pronunciation is Monongahela.
But before learning the Lenape language, Jim pronounced it differently.
I grew up in eastern Pennsylvania, and I always heard and said Monongahela.
And that's not that uncommon. We asked people around northern West Virginia and southern Pennsylvania how they pronounce it. Here's Grant Rumble, a Morgantown local.
It's the Monongahela River. Yeah, Monongahela.
My name is Nikki Tennant. I say Monongahela. That's just what I've always called it. I probably was taught that way.
So there's Monongahela, Monongahela, and Monongahela, but there's one other way people say it in southern Pennsylvania, where the town is named after the river. Here's Diana Barber.
It is Monongahela. Yeah, Hela. Yeah, Monongahela.
And in case you're all wondering, I used to live in Morgantown for like 15 years, and I pronounce it Monongahela, except when I pronounce it Monongahela. But technically, the word comes from the Lenape language. So here's Jim Rementer saying it once more.
Monongahela.
Let us know if there's a name of a place you're curious about in Appalachia, and we'll look into it. Send us a tweet at @InAppalachia, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. Today's show is all about how we interact with waters and our rivers. We depend on our rivers for survival, for recreation, and for transportation. But sometimes our industry fails to keep our rivers safe. That's what happened in Kingston, Tennessee in 2008. More than a billion gallons of coal ash flooded several homes and contaminated the Emory River. Coal ash is the byproduct that builds up when power companies produce electricity from coal. It's what's left over after you've burnt coal. Since 2008, there have been subsequent coal ash spills elsewhere throughout our region. Only recently have scientists begun to realize the scope of some of the long-term health effects of the 2008 coal ash spill in Tennessee. Broken Ground is a new podcast from the Southern Environmental Law Center. Host and producer Claudine Abade McElwain and her colleagues spent 6 months looking back at the impacts that the coal ash spill had for the community of Kingston and the workers who cleaned up the spill. Let's listen to the first part of this story.
I woke up to the awfulest noise and sound that I can imagine.
Millions of tons of ash and sludge came pouring out.
The spill was 100 times larger than the Exxon Valdez.
The prevailing myth is that it's safe.
Arsenic levels more than 100 times the acceptable amount.
In Kingston, Tennessee, efforts to clean up a giant spill of coal ash are going day and night.
There's nothing to warn these workers. There's not signs, there's not pamphlets, there's nothing.
The eyes was burning, the headaches, the coughing up of that jelly junk.
And now they're sick and dying, and no one will take responsibility for it.
This is Broken Ground, a podcast about environmental stories in the South and the people unearthing them. I'm Claudine Abade McElwain, and before I jumped headfirst into environmental issues, I was a producer and editor for more than a decade at NPR. I worked on really tight deadlines, but the kind of information I dig into now can take months and sometimes years to unravel. In this episode, we go digging for the story of coal ash. That's the toxic substance left over when coal is burned to make electricity. In America, we make about 130 million tons of it a year. It's enough to fill a million train cars. If you've never thought about coal ash or where it ends up, you're not alone. I never had. And I don't think that the Copeland family ever thought about it either. And they lived right across the water from a coal-fired power plant in Kingston, Tennessee. That plant was run by the Tennessee Valley Authority. They're better known as TVA. And it was making tons of coal ash every day.
You think that they know what they're doing and that everything's safe, that they're keeping an eye on it.
That's Chris Copeland in a 2008 interview. He grew up fishing, swimming, playing on the Swan Pond, right there next to the coal-fired power plant. He planned on living there the rest of his life, raising his two daughters there, growing old there. And then everything changed 3 days before Christmas in 2008.
I woke up to the awfulest noise and sound that I can imagine. I could hear crashing and popping, the noise. The wind was incredible. It seemed like it generated its own wind.
I mean, imagine that. It's the middle of the night. The power's out. So Chris Copeland throws on his clothes and he scrambles outside.
Didn't have any lights back there, so I got in the car and drove in the backyard and shined the headlights in the backyard. And it was just unbelievable. I mean, clumps of earth as big as our house were in the cove behind us.
Those clumps of earth that he's describing are actually huge mounds of coal ash. They'd come to be known as ash bergs. But he calls 911 and says there's a mudslide.
From County 911.
Yes, I'm over at the Swan Pond, and there's a heck of a mudslide or something that came through our backyard. I mean, there is unbelievable. The whole, we live on the cove back here, and it is full of mud.
Other neighbors start calling. They're confused. They don't know what's going on. Finally, emergency responders head to the scene.
All units responding to Swan Pond Circle. Seems to be officer advising the dikes have fallen. The dikes have fallen.
She's saying the dikes have fallen. What she means is that a six-story dirt wall that's meant to keep the coal ash sludge on the power plant property and out of the river has given way. I want to stop here for a minute and ask an obvious question that I asked when I first learned about coal ash ponds. why would utility companies tempt fate by putting coal ash on the edge of a river? It seems like a pretty dangerous thing to do. But when I learned more about power plants, I understood why. Power plants are built near water because they need lots of it to operate. River water is often key to keeping a power plant cool. Coal ash, a byproduct of burning coal, accumulates quickly, and shipping it to a landfill costs more than keeping it on site. So most power plant operators choose to leave it where it is and instead store the coal ash in open-air, water-filled dirt pits. It's called wet storage. And to this day, hundreds of power plants across the country do this. And that was the same method used at the Kingston fossil plant. Though the ash pond at Kingston had passed a TVA inspection 7 months earlier, the 60-foot dirt wall gave way overnight. It released nearly 50 years' worth of coal ash into the Emory and Clinch rivers. The next day, everyone would see just how epic of a disaster it was, and the news coverage would demonstrate that.
Millions of tons of ash and sludge came pouring out when a dike at a coal plant gave way this week.
An unnatural disaster along the Clinch River, a spill of sludge,
releasing a tidal wave of coal sludge into the area.
The ash coats a half mile square, sometimes as deep as 10 or 12 feet.
The spill was 100 times larger than the Exxon Valdez, and it was all coal ash.
Relatively speaking, the homeowners were lucky. A dozen homes were swamped by ash and three were destroyed, but no one was injured or killed. They were lucky that it was the middle of the night in winter. Had it been summer, a nice day when people might have been playing in the pond, things could have gone so differently. As this disaster unfolds, people across the country, like the people in Kingston, are learning what coal ash is. They're learning that EPA didn't regulate this hazardous waste, even though as far back as 1980, Congress was asking the agency if it should. NPR reporter Elizabeth Shogren interviewed Matt Hale, the head of the EPA's Solid Waste Office, about this lack of oversight.
So basically, EPA has been studying this problem for 28 years, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Why has it taken so long?
There's been a considerable amount of technical work. Simply the processes require this amount of time.
Environmentalists like Eric Schaefer, head of the Environmental Integrity Project, call BS on all of this.
The prevailing myth is that it's safe. We have EPA sort of buying into that for many years and really refusing to regulate this material for what it is, which is highly toxic ash that leaches metals like arsenic and cadmium and mercury into drinking water and into rivers and creeks.
And so now, as homeowners in Kingston are actually learning what's in the coal ash, they are understandably starting to freak out. They're hearing that it has things in it like mercury, cadmium, chromium, selenium, aluminum, antimony, barium, boron, chlorine, cobalt, manganese, nickel, thallium, and vanadium. Heavy metals like these, even trace amounts, lead to health problems, which is why it's shocking when TVA's Anda Ray, who was their environmental executive at the time, goes on to 60 Minutes and basically equates coal ash to dirt.
I'd say that the constituents, the things that are in the coal ash, are the same things that are naturally occurring in soil and rock.
So is it like dirt? Would you say that? Would you say that sentence? That stuff is like dirt?
That ash material is higher than dirt in two areas, and that is arsenic and thallium.
Let's talk about arsenic and thallium. Arsenic causes skin lesions and cancer. It's linked to heart disease and diabetes. Thallium can cause problems with the nervous system, headaches, fatigue, sleep disorders. People in Kingston are starting to talk. What would happen if this stuff got into their drinking water? So 4 days after the spill, with the Tennessee Valley Authority's PR machine up and running, spokesman John Moulton assures residents.
Our sampling has determined that there's been no indication that the water would not meet drinking water standards.
I'm not sure what he meant by no indication, but soon officials were flip-flopping from day to day as to whether the local water was safe to drink. Understandably, Kingston residents were becoming skeptical. Then the mayor of Kingston, Troy Beetz, decides he's going to set his community's mind at ease during a press conference by pulling a little stunt.
This is a cup of Kingston City water that came from my house and out of my tap, and I just want to drink it for you right here. And I'm going to be fine.
Mayor Beetz hoped his city would bounce back quickly, and TVA implied it would.
Any estimate as to how long it would take to clean all this up?
They are being fairly optimistic at this point. They're hoping to have the entire area cleaned up within 6 weeks.
If you look at the photos from the time of the spill, 6 weeks is insane. 6 weeks was never going to happen. It doesn't matter how many dump trucks they had working around the clock. The stuff was deep and it was everywhere. In the end, it didn't take weeks or even months. It took years, 6 years, before the EPA declared that the job was good enough. And though much of the coal ash was shipped to landfills in Alabama and Georgia, TVA said 500,000 tons was too hard to remove from the river. And so it's still there today. As for the cost of the 6 years of cleanup, $1.7 billion, which utility customers in Tennessee are still paying for. But there are people who had to pay a much higher price. Earlier, we said that people in Kingston were so lucky no one died because of this coal ash spill. Well, that's no longer true.
There's going to be a lot of widows, a lot of widowers. It doesn't matter what I report, and it doesn't matter what happens in this case. There's going to be a lot of people whose families are just going to suffer.
That's Jamie Satterfield. She's an award-winning investigative reporter for the Knoxville News Sentinel, and she's been covering the story of the workers who cleaned up the Kingston coal ash spill.
When the spill first happened, there was a crush of media. There was a crush of environmental groups. All of the focus was on the community, the impact on the community. No one, including my own news organization, cast a glance over at the workers. So we're writing stories that this stuff might be terribly dangerous. It might be, you know. But nobody is going, why aren't those workers in suits? You know, why is the EPA guys all Tyvek'd out and the workers aren't? Nobody questioned that.
They didn't have any protective gear when they were working out there.
No, none at all. I mean, you know, your basic hard hat, your, shiny vest and blue jeans and T-shirts. That's what they were working in.
Directly after the December spill, EPA workers show up in their Tyvek hazmat suits to assess the damage. They do some testing, and they become concerned for the safety of workers who are going to be knee-deep in coal ash day after day. But by February, the EPA turns the cleanup job over to TVA. And TVA brings on a contractor called Jacobs Engineering to help. And now that Jacobs was managing the coal ash removal, the worker's safety was in their hands. But Jamie says the workers were kept in the dark.
They were never told that it was dangerous. They were told that there was nothing wrong with the stuff, that they could eat a pound of it a day and still be safe. Well, that just on its face didn't make sense, right? Because what I had discovered is the American Coal Ash Association doesn't even make that kind of claim. I thought, surely to goodness, a responsible government contractor is not going to lie in that fashion.
When you first started looking into the cases of these workers, were you skeptical?
Yes, I was skeptical. And of course, as an investigative reporter, I always go into an investigation with this idea that this is probably not true. It just makes me look a little harder at things. And so I was skeptical. I needed proof. So by the third interview, I got it. A worker had secretly videoed conversations with supervisors out on that site in which the supervisors could be heard very clearly telling them that their breathing problems were pollen, not the ash, that this stuff was safe.
I don't think it's the ash because I've got the same allergy problems that I've never had before, and I talked to my doctor and it's not the ash. It's the pollen this year. It's horrible. It's the pollen. Okay. Give it a couple more weeks. Take an Allegra or two.
There were secret recordings about them being told that if they pressed this issue, if they demanded protective gear, they would lose their jobs.
You think I'd hang myself?
Yeah.
And bear in mind, this is good money for these people. These are working people, and this is good money. TVA pays well.
Don't what?
Don't hang yourself with your own.
Once I got those videos, I was off to the races.
That was investigative reporter Jamie Satterfield. Her reporting into the aftermath of the 2008 coal ash spill in Kingston, Tennessee, won some major awards. Satterfield reports for the Knoxville News Sentinel. That audio story was produced and narrated by Claudine Abade McElwain, who hosts the podcast called Broken Ground. Now, we don't have time for the entire episode about the Kingston coal ash spill, but I really recommend you take the time to listen to the rest of Claudine's reporting at brokengroundpodcast.org. It's devastating to learn what scientists now know about the effects that the coal ash spill is having for so many people. She gets into it. Of course, it's not just people who are affected by water pollution. The rivers and creeks throughout central Appalachia are home to hundreds of freshwater mussels. According to the Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries, nearly one-third of the 1,000 species of freshwater mussels exist in the United States, and Appalachia has a lion's share of this diversity residing in the southeastern drainages of the Ohio, Tennessee, Cumberland, and Mobile rivers. In fact, the Tennessee River Basin alone has more species than Africa and more than China and Europe combined. Each can filter 5 to 10 gallons of water daily, but pollution, land use change, and a changing climate threaten their existence. In recent years, many mussels have landed on the endangered species list. Reporter Brittany Patterson spent some time with a veteran biologist in West Virginia who reflected on her 3 decades protecting mussels.
Janet Clayton is standing thigh deep in a back channel of the Elk River. Clad in a wetsuit and knee pads, the silver-haired biologist with the West Virginia Division of Natural Resources reaches into a bright orange mesh bag submerged in water. Inside are a half dozen mussels she plucked from the Rocky River bottom.
This is called a long solid. As it gets older, it gets really long.
Clayton holds an earthy-colored shell, about the size of a computer mouse, in the palm of her hand, and she easily identifies others.
This is a pocketbook, a wavy rayed lamp mussel, kidney shell.
Clayton, a West Virginia native, has studied mussels for about 3 decades. She began her career researching aquatic bugs, but quickly switched gears. Today, she heads West Virginia's mussel program, a program she helped build.
Mussels are very important to the environment.
In addition to filtering water, mussel excrement is a tasty meal for macroinvertebrates and benthic critters. Many mammals enjoy mussels as a tasty snack, and they help keep our river bottoms in place. They're also sensitive.
Freshwater mussels are the most endangered group of animals in the country.
Tierra Curry is a Kentucky-based scientist with the Center for Biological Diversity, which advocates for federal protections for mussels and other threatened species. Good water quality is vital to the health of mussels, and humans have not always treated waterways with care. Chemical discharges, excess sediment, and dams all pose challenges to mussels.
So as we don't do a good enough job taking care of our rivers and streams, the freshwater mussels are on the front lines of paying the price for that.
Today, scientists know a lot more about freshwater mussels and how to protect them. And a lot of that, Curry says, has to do with Janet Clayton.
Janet Clayton is a total hero for freshwater mussels.
Working with partners across the Ohio Valley, Clayton developed mussel surveying methods that have been widely adopted. Her team set up 26 long-term monitoring sites, like this one on the Elk River. On this day, 4 divers dropped their mussels at a folding table erected in the stream. Mussels tagged with little silver plastic stickers are measured. Then they're returned to the water. 5 years ago, Clayton and her team pulled hundreds of dead and dying Three Ridge mussels from this river. The cause remains a mystery.
I'm concerned. I'm majorly concerned.
Clayton is retiring next summer and says while in some ways the field has advanced, she fears some waterways will never again be healthy enough to support mussels. And new threats have emerged, like climate change and the growing natural gas industry.
Mussels live for decades in our streams. So they're like the canary in the coal mine. If mussels are dying, which in this case they are, what's in this water that's causing them to die? We need to wake up and pay attention to what's out there.
For now, Clayton is taking every opportunity to spend time in the water, her preferred office. And she says she plans to stick around to train her successor. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Brittany Patterson.
In a minute, we'll hear about a veteran who found peace and healing on the river. But first, maybe you can help us with something we're working on. We asked our listeners to send us questions you'd like us to investigate. We selected four options, and now we'd like for you to vote on your favorite. One thought is to investigate the mystery behind the Brown Mountain Lights in North Carolina. Or we could explore the history of moonshine. Another question we could answer is whether West Virginia could be a self-sustaining state. Or we could look into what makes the folkways, culture, and lives of people in Northern Appalachia unique. Which should we get into? Go to wvpublic.org to cast your vote before midnight, Wednesday, September 3rd. We'll announce the winning question in next week's show and air the story we report in a couple of months. Thanks again to everyone who sent us your questions. Also, this might be a good time to mention that we'd love to know what you think of our new theme music. Send us a note to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org or send us a tweet at @inappalachia. A few months ago, we introduced you to our Folklife Corps reporters who are helping us cover more stories about arts and culture throughout our region. Today, we're excited to share with you the first story from that effort. Now, when we think about bugs, most of us think mosquito bites or shooing flies or ants from a picnic. I don't know, maybe how lightning bugs can make a summer evening seem magical. Well, Folklife Corps reporter Mason Adams brings us the story of a man with an unusual appreciation for bugs. He's an Army vet who says fly fishing saved his life.
Cal Chanet spent 2.5 years deployed in Afghanistan. He saw intense fighting and suffered concussions that led to seizures. When he returned to the U.S., he started taking college classes, but then dropped out to follow the jam band Phish around the country. He got into drugs.
You know, I was kind of strung out and needed some help.
He spent 18 months on the road and spiraled out of control.
I had 8 accidental heroin overdoses in a year. The whole time it was like, man, I don't want to be doing this.
Then, one day, on his way to the beach, Kyle says he saw a sign for a Veterans Affairs hospital in Richmond, Virginia. He'd been up for 7 days straight on a methamphetamine binge, and he wanted to kill himself. He was in a car with the guy who'd made the meth. Kyle pulled off at a Walmart and convinced the guy to get out of the car. Then he apologized, locked the doors, tossed some money out the window, and drove off to check himself into the hospital.
I went through a month-long rehab program, but before that I was basically in the psych ward, you know, detoxing from opiates and other stuff.
The VA moved Kyle to a facility in Salem, Virginia, which sits at the eastern gateway to central Appalachia.
It was probably the best thing that ever happened, you know.
After rehab, Kyle tried to settle into life in the Roanoke Valley. He spent a lot of time at the VA in programs for disabled vets. He was learning how to garden when someone told him about Project Healing Waters. It was another program for disabled vets focused on fly fishing. Bob Crawshaw is a Navy vet who's taught fly fishing to veterans for years. Bob was one of the first people Kyle met in the program.
We take vets that have never fished, and we walk them into the middle of the river, and it just washes over them, and they just relax. They just go.
He says when the vets step into a trout stream, peace comes over them.
Kyle's seen it. I've seen it. Kyle's felt it. I've felt it.
On a trip to Wolf Creek in Bland County, Virginia, Kyle, Bob, and a handful of other vets are trying to catch trout. One succeeded on his first cast, but the others are having to work a little harder to get a bite.
Good bug activity going around here.
This tree here is full of black caddis.
Man, I'm loving it. Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're mating. Some got eggs on them.
Yeah.
It's mid-May, which means aquatic insects are hatching and buzzing. Bob and Kyle know the flies well, and they know which fish like to eat them. Occasionally, a trout breaks the surface of the water. Bob says, that's great and all, but even if they weren't biting, that'd be fine too.
The fish aren't the reason we're here. It's the excuse we use to be here. And understanding everything that's in the envelope of the Army guys, what do you call it? Situational awareness. Understanding everything around you and why it's happening. It's the mystery of it all.
Situational awareness. That's something soldiers need to stay alive. When Kyle served in Afghanistan, he was usually the first guy through the door when his unit was searching for enemy combatants. He had to immediately process his surroundings and detect potential threats. A stray wire, a person holding a gun or a knife. These details were crucial to life or death. But that hypervigilance can make it hard to adjust to life back home. You can't just turn it off. Kyle says that even today, 7 years after he got out of the Army, his eyes still dart around, followed by his arms and upper torso. It's the muscle memory of maneuvering with a bulletproof vest and rifle. Bob says fly fishing takes those instincts and applies them to a serene, peaceful environment. On the banks of Wolf Creek, Kyle sees what kind of bugs are in the air and on the water. He uses that information to choose a lure that mimics what he's seeing. He's constantly adapting his actions based on what's happening around him in the stream.
So you see that right there on top of the water? So that big thing, that's a crane fly. I have a lot of crane fly imitations. It's a mayfly that just popped off the water. So we got a lot of bug activity here. I just saw a damsel limp dancing around. So, yeah, man.
Kyle got so into fly fishing that the classes at the VA started to bore him. He craved more. So he started watching YouTube videos to learn new fly making techniques. He bought tons of gear. He went fishing every week.
And then I became a volunteer really fast in teaching guys, and I still am.
He even started selling the flies. He had mentees and mentors, and one of his fly tying mentors had a daughter, Jessica.
My dad kind of took him under his wing, which my dad does. He's that kind of person, but there was always something special about Kyle.
And Kyle felt there was something special about Jessica. They met at a festival in Roanoke. She felt a connection right away.
I told my mom, I'm going to marry that man. That first time I ever met Kyle, I went home that day. And I was talking to my dad about him, and my dad actually warned me off of Kyle. He was protective over Kyle and not me.
Jessica's dad didn't want his daughter to break Kyle's heart, but that didn't happen. They married and bought a house in Roanoke. Fly fishing and fly tying have been part of their relationship since the beginning.
I think at this point I know more about fly fishing and fly tying than a lot of people. I'm slowly gotten used to like the names of the material. You know, he can tell me about a fly and tell me the material he's using or the hooks he's using, and I can visualize pretty well what he's talking about.
Kyle blends old school and new school techniques to make flies that are utterly his. For example, he'll use a modern neon-colored synthetic thread, but mix it with natural feathers, all tied in a traditional way. The other thing that makes Kyle's flies stand out are their eyes. They move and cause the fly to move, which apparently makes them more appetizing to fish. He's reluctant to share what he calls his recipe for the eyes, but he says it involves a blend of glues that keep them from falling off in the water. Kyle's fly tying workshop takes up a sizable room on the second floor in their house. Every surface is covered with hooks, various kinds of hair and fur, feathers, synthetic threads. There's a big desk with a dozen or more drawers, each filled with, you guessed it, more fly tying stuff. Kyle spends hours here, and Jessica often hangs out with him.
And so he ties these beautiful flies, and I actually take them and turn them into jewelry and keychains. So I embed them in resin. I have a necklace here. He could tell you the type of fly that's in it.
It's like basically a dry fly Adams made out of snowshoe rabbit feet and grizzly hackle.
Let me translate that for you. The Adams is a fly Kyle ties that's meant to resemble a few different insects, including mayflies and caddisflies. Snowshoe rabbit describes the kind of fur that Kyle used, and grizzly hackle is in fact not grizzly bear fur, but a style of feather. Basically, it looks like a hook with hair and fur sprouting off of it. But I'm not a fish. Jessica's taken it and embedded it into an opaque resin. So now it's a pendant on a silver necklace.
So I get kind of a little bit of my own little bit of creativity. I don't have his creativity, but I get to take it and turn, you know, something that's, you know, a very much a sport into something that has some beauty to it.
And Kyle takes something used to make beauty to help him with the sport. Before he married Jessica, he had to order the core of his flies, the shanks, online. But not anymore.
He took a pair of my pliers and used them to make his shanks. He stole those from me and pretty much ruined those for anything I could ever use them for.
That was my aha moment.
Yeah, that really sparked a whole different level of his fly tying career because he was able to make his own shanks. So that was cool that was a little bit of, you know, my contribution to what he does.
So Jessica contributes to Kyle's fly tying and he contributes to her jewelry making. He's also paying it forward by working with other vets, like Moyer Edwards. Like Kyle, Moyer struggled to adjust to civilian life after serving in the military. He also loves fly fishing.
I'm going to be doing it for as long as I'm able.
Moyer served 20 years in the Air Force as a mechanic. He learned to tie flies by reading books, but then he found Project Healing Waters and he met Kyle.
Kyle has given me some flies that he tied, and I try to imitate them. And he's a good man. He'll come in sometimes and he'll just say, here's a fly. You take it, you know.
Moyer says Kyle's ties are better than anything he's ever bought in a store or online.
They are just as good. They're hand-tied. They're not machines. No machines doing it. They are hand-tied flies, and they're tied very well. I'm going to call him my master. He's that good.
On the trip to Wolf Creek, Moyer's the vet who caught a trout on his first cast. Kyle can't land a trout, but he does catch a couple of Roanoke bass. After lunch, Kyle and Moyer chat for a few minutes before getting back on the creek. They're not swapping war stories, but talking about, what else? Fishing.
Yeah, it makes it easier to cast.
Oh, do
it? Yeah, it does.
Okay. Well, with a bigger fly.
Yeah.
And bigger flies are hard, kind of a little harder to cast.
Yeah, but some of them flies, man, they're pretty light. It's mainly deer hair and flash.
It's small talk among friends. Low stakes, set aside a burbling creek that's alive with hatching insects, lurking fish, singing birds, and even a small water snake making its way upstream. For these veterans, it's a chance to linger a bit longer, doing what they love. From Bland County, Virginia, this is Mason Adams for Inside Appalachia.
Kyle and Jessica sell their fly ties online, mostly through social media. We've posted photos of Kyle's fly ties with moving eyes on our website. That story is part of our Folklife Reporting Project, a partnership with West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Inside Appalachia and the Folklife Program of the West Virginia Humanities Council. Find more Folklife stories at wvpublic.org/InsideAppalachia. So till next week, thanks for joining me as we travel throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Southern Environmental Law Center and their podcast, Broken Ground. Music in today's show was provided by Matt Jackfort, Blue Dot Sessions, and Dinosaur Burps. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Kara Lofton edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org to sign up for our new Inside Appalachia newsletter. On our website, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories, or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Glynis Board. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.